being, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome some high school students. Is it Ron Colley or Ron Sully? Or neither?
Ron
Colley. Pardon me?
Ron Colley.
Ron Colley, high school students. Would they stand? There are 30 of them, apparently. Good. Thank you and welcome. And we also have students from the University of Wisconsin Pre-Law Society. Would they stand, please? Thank you. We welcome you also. The high school students are here with us with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to attend the oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, briefs are sent to them, and they do extra assignments about the case, come to oral argument, and meet with a justice at noon. You are all welcome to join the students at noon in the meeting with the justice. The discussion will be about the procedures of the court in deciding cases. It will not be about the substantive issues in the case. For those of you who have not received summaries of the case and wish to read the summary, so you better understand oral argument, the marshal will supply you with a summary. Would you raise your hand if you wish a summary? I see someone going around. Fine. All right, I assume we're all prepared, so let me introduce to you the court. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. She is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right are three empty chairs. Ordinarily, Justice John Wilcox sits to my immediate right. Justice Pat Crooks sits on his right, and on the far right usually sits Justice Patience Robinsack. The three empty chairs represent three justices who will not participate in this case. We sit with a quorum of four. I will now call the case 2004-AP-377, Julie M. Rossa versus Todd Rungstedt. Arguing on behalf of Todd Rungstedt et al. Is Michael P. Crooks for 17.5 minutes. Brady Williamson will argue for the amici curiae, 7.5 minutes. We then have 15 minutes of Pamela R. McGillivray, is that right, counsel? For 15 minutes on behalf of Ms. Lassa, and John Skilton, Attorney Skilton, arguing 15 minutes for Ms. Lassa, with a 5-minute rebuttal by Michael Crooks. Is the lineup correct? All right, we shall proceed. Mr. Crooks.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My hope is that the way that the bench is weighted is a premonition of the outcome of this case.
Well, if it is, you'll have to tell us what you mean.
We're here because an elected official sued for defamation and sought to discover the identity of anonymous critics. We are also here to discover what protections the state of Wisconsin is going to afford the constitutional rights of defendants in a defamation suit filed by a public official. Fortunately, both the United States Supreme Court and three other state Supreme Courts have rendered decisions which I think will guide and help this court in arriving at a decision in this particular case. In McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Committee, found at 514 U.S. 334, the U.S. Supreme Court held that anonymous pamphleteering was an honorable tradition worthy of First Amendment protections. That court stated anonymity is a shield against the tyranny of the majority in striking down a regulation requiring the identity of the producers of a pamphlet expressing a viewpoint contrary to a tax levy for a school referendum. Thereafter, in the city of Littleton, another U.S. Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court cautioned that when we're dealing with First Amendment rights and First Amendment privileges, before they are forfeited, processes must be in place to guarantee that adequate hearing is had with respect to those issues. That court said that a delay in accepting appeals by the appellate court often moots issues which later may have arose on appeal. More recently, as I mentioned at the outset of my argument, three other states' Supreme Courts have taken heart what the U.S. Supreme Court said in McIntyre and in City of Littleton, and they've done exactly what we're asking this court to do here. Those cases were all decided within the last year, and one of them was decided within the last month. In Finch versus Doe...
What are you asking us to do, counsel?
Your Honor, I'm asking this court to do three things. I'm asking this court to vacate the sanctions that were rendered against Mr. Rongstead because there was no due process afforded him relative to the constitutional issues, because we were following existing Supreme Court law at the time, because we had no ruling on the motion to dismiss the alleged defamatory card, and because the sanctions themselves are not rationally related to Rongstead's post-lawsuit conduct. In addition to that, I'm asking this court to issue a rule that before a trial court judge can compel the disclosure of otherwise protected information from a constitutional standpoint, in this case the First Amendment, that the plaintiff either has to overcome a motion to dismiss, or, as the Delaware Supreme Court recently ruled in Cahill, that the plaintiff must make a prima facie showing that the plaintiff can in fact prove a defamation claim. The last thing I'm asking this court to do is to exercise its supervisory authority and indicate that when a claim of substantiated or substantial privilege, again in this case a First Amendment claim, is made, that an appellate court must review that before a litigant at the lower court level is subjected to the need for disclosure or immediate disclosure.
Mr. Crooks, if I could ask, regarding the prima facie showing of defamation, if the court were to go down that route, is it one of the elements that the plaintiff would have to establish to show defamation, malice? And how does one get at malice before one gets disclosure?
Justice Butler, you raise a good point. And what the Cahill Court, the Delaware Supreme Court, said was, we're going to accept a prima facie case from the plaintiff if the plaintiff can establish all of the elements of defamation except actual malice. Because I think, Justice Butler, you recognize, and I think the Delaware court recognized, that in order to establish actual malice, one would need discovery, and one would need the discovery that was sought in this particular case.
Okay, so let's talk about the motion to dismiss for a moment, okay? Ultimately, you did get a ruling from the trial court to dismiss this.
Ultimately. Seven months after it was filed.
Right. And you filed the motion after discovery began?
The first thing I did in this case, Your Honor, was I moved for a stay of the discovery to allow for the time to file a motion to dismiss.
But you did get a motion, you did get a ruling on the motion to dismiss, and you lost it.
Ultimately, we lost it.
And that's not subject to appeal now.
I disagree with Your Honor. I think it is subject to appeal. All issues underlying the merits of this claim were stipulated to be up for appeal in front of this court or the Court of Appeals.
But it was dismissed by stipulation, the complaint.
The complaint was dismissed by stipulation, but if the court looks at the specific language of the stipulation, what it indicates is all issues related to the defamation, the underlying sanctions, and the basis for opposing them are up for appeal.
The new position is court has to rule on a motion to dismiss first, if I understand your position. And then you can go to discovery. But on discovery, you're not going to be subject to sanction unless it's frivolous, unless your motion for a privilege is frivolous. And that if you lose in the trial court, you should have an automatic right to the Court of Appeals.
Assuming that the basis for not answering the discovery is First Amendment privilege.
I assume you'd give the same automatic right to appeal to the other side.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you think this is up before us as to whether there was a prima facie showing of defamation?
I mean, frankly, Judge or Justice, if you look at the record, there was no showing at all in this case. But I think that this court determines that the piece at issue is not capable of defamation, a de novo decision that this court can make, then the sanctions per se were inappropriate.
You know, I'm looking at page 32 of your brief. Long after the sanctions at issue on this appeal had been imposed, the trial court denied Rungstad's motion to dismiss. I'm reading at the bottom paragraph. While that decision is not technically before this court, because the defamation claim was dismissed pursuant to stipulation, the fact that the defamation claim lacked merit is relevant to the propriety of the sanctions imposed. Do you stand by that?
I do, Your Honor. And I think
so the only relevance is in terms of the propriety of the sanctions.
I would agree with that.
Okay. And the merits of the claim are not before us.
They are as they go to the sanctions.
Only.
Correct.
Okay.
So when I read the stipulation, which I don't immediately have in front of me, when it said that the defamation suit is dismissed with prejudice, I think that's what it said, with prejudice, or maybe it said on its merits, but, you know, with prejudice, how does that relate to the question and answers that you're just having here? I assumed that with prejudice means, not contesting merit.
In the strictest sense, yes. But this court has three ways in which it can vacate the sanctions. And one of those ways is if the court reviews the postcard de novo and determines that it wasn't capable of defamatory meaning, because if it does that, then it goes to the propriety of the sanctions in this particular case. So does the court have to make a finding that the card was not capable of defamatory meaning? No, but if the court were to make that finding, one of the things that we tried to preserve when we worked out the stipulation in this case, that would be one way that this court could undo the sanctions.
Was it defamatory?
I don't believe it was defamatory.
Why?
Number one, there's a number of reasons why I don't think it's defamatory. Number one, we're dealing with a public official, so there's a higher standard available or applied in that particular case. Number two, if the court reads the piece and looks at it in detail, I don't believe there's anything in the piece that's untrue. All the piece really does, despite its clever way of doing it, all the piece really does is draws an associational relationship between then-Senator Quala and then-Assemblywoman Lassa, something that we do all the time when people are engaged in public life and running for public office. many times we make decisions on who we're going to vote for, who we're going to support, based on the company that those folks keep. And that's how I read this piece.
If I could, Mr. Crooks, you almost have me on that until I get to the last line, and I wonder if you would comment on the last line in the piece that says, and most importantly, will you please clean up your act? That seems to go a little bit beyond guilt by association.
I think, Your Honor, that that can be read to going toward the legislature and the governmental body as a whole, and that's my interpretation of it. I think what this piece is really about is what's going on in the government of Wisconsin at the time that the caucus investigations are going on. And if you read the piece in that context, I believe that that's what the last line is directed at.
Returning for a moment to
ask you, was the defamation complaint properly pleaded in the beginning, in the sense that it identified exactly what the defamation, the defamatory words were or pictures were?
No, and that was one of the issues that was raised in our motion to dismiss. I don't believe it was. It was not pled with the requisite level of detail required in a defamation claim. Additionally, it sort of evolved as time went on. If the court looks to the transcript at the hearing on the motion to dismiss, at that hearing was the first time that Mr. Garvey raised an issue concerning use of the terms hooked up in the piece and the meaning that he attributed to that. So I agree with your point, Justice Prosser. I don't think it was pled with the requisite level of specificity. That was one of the bases for the request to dismiss it.
And that has relevance for the sanction?
I believe it all does, Justice Abrahamson. I think that if you look at the totality of the situation, you look at the card that we're dealing with, you look at the lack of process that we believe we received, and you look at the fact that the alleged defamatory piece is not defamatory in fact, and you look at the fact that it wasn't pled with the requisite level of specificity, you got no basis for the sanctions.
Counsel, First Amendment rights are very important.
Agreed.
We all concede that, especially in the field of political debate. And people have fairly wide latitude in what they can say about public officials, even with the malice standard, right?
Agreed.
Because it doesn't even have to be true. You just have to be reckless and not finding out that it's true. That's what malice means. And anonymity of the pamphleteer is a long tradition in history in this state. And anonymity of membership of the of organizations is also protected. That's the NAACP case. And we have Buckley v. Vallejo, which recognizes, as do all the cases, I assume, that you have to balance, right?
Agreed.
And so you can disclose names. And what we're disclosing now are names of people who contributed to for the payment of this pamphlet or circular, right, that was mailed.
That was ultimately what it was whittled down to, yes.
It was whittled down to that. And the issue then becomes is whether the compelled disclosure would chill association. And if it chills association, then the government must show a compelling interest in obtaining the information. Is that roughly right?
I agree with your analysis completely.
All right. So what kind of chilling was there, and what do you think is the compelling government interest here in not obtaining the information? I've turned it around.
You have turned it around. I mean, yes. You are correct. The chilling? ruining the business of Mr. Rongstad and others who do what he does.
What does he do?
He puts out politically timely pieces relative to the issues of the day.
You somewhere say this is an issue ad. Do you still stand by that?
I believe it is an issue ad. It's an issue ad directed at the corruption in government in the state of Wisconsin at the time that the caucus investigations are going on.
An official who was up for election in a few days.
Well, if you look at the piece closely, she was, I agree with you, she was up for election in the assembly, but the piece talks about a potential race for the Senate, and she wasn't up for that at the time that this was disseminated within her jurisdiction.
Okay, so what's your balance?
Well, my balance is, first talking about the chilling effect, we've got the business ramifications to Mr. Rongstad and others. We've got the chilling of anyone who wants to speak anonymously on any topic through a vehicle like the Alliance for Working Wisconsin, which Mr. Rongstad ran. We've got the, I guess, flat-out denial of the constitutional right to do that if we require disclosure, because people who want to speak anonymously aren't going to speak at all if they fear that their anonymous speech will become public speech. So those are the major chilling effects that I see with respect to it. What's the compelling state interest? To be honest, with these facts in this particular situation, I don't see a compelling state interest. One could argue, and one, Mr. Garvey, for instance, did argue, that Julie Lassa has a right to clear her name. That's a compelling state interest. She is, however, a public official. She does have access to the bully pulpit, and she did exhibit...
If you defeat her at the polls.
If you defeat her at the polls, she doesn't have access to the bully pulpit?
Don't you want political race to be placed on honest and fair comment, whether right or wrong, so that the people can really choose? Is that a government interest?
Of course it is a government interest. And we have vehicles in place called the elections laws to deal with that. And we also have a case in Wisconsin that this court is well familiar with, WMC, which essentially stands for the proposition that unless it is express advocacy, speech like that at issue in this case is permissible. And that case follows Buckley versus Vallejo at the U.S. Supreme Court level. So if Justice Abrahamson, you are correct that that would be a compelling state interest, but we also have the ability of Ms. Lassa at the time to respond to it and to get access to response that others would not otherwise get.
Mr. Crooks, if I could follow up on the Chief's question. With respect to the interests at stake, don't we also have an interest of the voters to have accurate and correct information without presuming whether we're dealing with defamation? Isn't that an interest that has to be factored in as well?
It is, Justice Butler. I don't disagree with you. I see that my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Crooks. Mr. Williamson, you have 7.5 minutes representing the amici.
Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Brady Williamson with LaFollette, Godfrey & Kahn, and I appear here this morning on behalf of seven organizations which you have been kind enough to permit to file a non-party brief and kind enough to permit 7 minutes of oral argument. Because my time is brief, I'd like to begin by responding directly to the Chief's question. What is it you want? What the seven organizations who've appeared as a non-party, in this case, want is to ensure that the extraordinarily troublesome procedural history of this case never recurs. This case is not about absolutes. Perhaps, with due process, the defendant might have been compelled to disclose the names of his group supporters. Perhaps, with due process, the defendant's rights and the rights of his members might have given way to the right of the plaintiff to, quote, clear her name. Perhaps, even, with due process, a jury might have found the statements in this flyer defamatory. I doubt that, but it is possible. All of that, perhaps, could have happened with due process, but there was no due process here.
Way.
In the first way, Your Honor, the trial court made it practically impossible for the plaintiff, for the defendant to protect the rights that he was trying to assert for himself and for his members.
Well, now, let's just talk about this. He, at one point, I think, said he had a lot of members, but ultimately he only revealed one member. Isn't that right?
I believe the record shows that, Your Honor.
Were there other members, or don't you know?
I don't know, Your Honor.
All right. Now, from my understanding, I don't know where there isn't due process. There was a complaint filed, an answer, a motion, discovery. The judge heard issues on discovery. The judge heard the motion to dismiss. There was just, seemed to me, there was a lot of process.
Well, there was indeed a lot of process, but it occurred in precisely the wrong order.
Well, okay, maybe. I'm not willing to say yes. But, you know, if it all gets done at the end, what difference does it make?
It makes a great deal of difference, Chief Justice, because by the time it was all said and done, the defendant had disclosed the identity of individuals that he believed, and we believe the Constitution requires, be kept confidential. Let me put it in terms that this Court knows best. The trial court violated a cardinal rule of appellate practice. He made a decision before he had to make it. The trial court decided a constitutional issue in, I might add, 18 hours, when what the trial court should have done was to resolve the motion to dismiss issues, to resolve the issues identified by Justice Prosser in his reference to 802.03 sub 6, which requires specificity in defamation complaints, and for good reason, so that any defendant in any defamation case can know the precise words with which she or he has to deal. And you can take everything that the trial court did in this extraordinary 10-week period and piece by piece say, well, that was okay, this was okay, and maybe he was a little quick on the trigger with the constitutional decision, but it was all there. The point is, it was all there in the wrong order. The court didn't go A, B, C. It went Z, A, B, C. And that was wrong.
But once it got to A and said there was an okay complaint here, then isn't it harmless error?
No, Your Honor, because the sanctions cannot stand without two foundations. And they cannot stand unless first the trial court was correct in compelling the disclosure, and second, unless the trial court was correct in saying that as a matter of law, this broadside was capable of a defamatory meaning. And ever since 1912, this court has hammered home the point that it is the trial court's responsibility to determine in any defamation case whether the publication is capable of a defamatory meaning. Now, we can debate here, as Justice Prosser suggested, whether this is piece is capable of a defamatory meaning. It isn't, because it's opinion. More importantly, it is opinion in the context of a political campaign, where the First Amendment, we know from New York Times versus Sullivan, provides the greatest breathing room for speech. Look, this piece of literature was ugly. It was guilt by association. It was unfair. But that's what our political process permits. And the voters decide. And I might add, the voters decided in this case with a 67% vote in both the primary and the general election that this state representative should become a state senator. She vindicated her reputation in a very strong and compelling way. And one of the other things that's troubling here, I think, about the order in which these issues were decided, there is no doubt that the trial court shaped its procedure with an eye toward the special election. In the February 4th and 5th transcript, which is part of the record, the court says it's important to get this decided now because the plaintiff has a right to clear her name. I am troubled by a court tailoring its schedule to the election calendar, unless, of course, it involves the right to vote. Several justices have asked about, well, isn't there a state interest in honest and accurate campaign discussion? And the answer is, of course there is. But in the end, especially in this state, I would submit, we depend on the voters to make those decisions. And if there are demonstrably false statements of fact, then we have two methods to deal with them, legal, not political. The first is Section 12.05. The second is a defamation case. When I said to you at the outset, this is not about absolutes, the plaintiff has every right to bring a defamation case, carrying the burden, of course, of the constitutional privilege and actual malice.
Tell you what I have is a problem. In your red lights on, the problem I have is I recognize you represent the amicus, and yet you're interested is essentially for the future, in this case, is a vehicle, as I see it, for those interests. But we have a case which has actual facts that the plaintiff, the defendant here, could have continued on, come up here, raised all these issues, but they didn't. There was a stipulation, and the posture that we've got the case in is there was a motion to dismiss. It failed. And as Mr. Crook's brief indicates, that issue is here only tangentially, not directly. And what is here is issues of the sanctions and issues of the First Amendment. And so why should the court reach out and decide the issues that you present when they're really not before us?
Two answers, Chief Justice. The first is that the sanctions cannot be sustained if the trial court was wrong, either procedurally or substantively. The second reason is that the non-parties that I'm representing are in the same position as the court. We take the case as we found it, just as you take the case as you found it. And our concern, quite frankly, is not whether the defendant has to pay $65,000 in sanctions. That is of no matter. What is of great matter is how this court decides this case. And as I said at the outset, I think we should all have an interest in ensuring that the facts of this case never recur.
Chief, if I could follow up.
Justice Butler.
Please. Mr. Williamson, one thing that concerns me, and you're correct, the case is here really on sanctions. That's the issue before us. And this, for purposes of this question, let's say the trial court was wrong. Isn't the respondent under an the petitioner here, isn't the petitioner under a responsibility to follow the trial court's orders unless and until they're overturned? And if that is the case, even if the trial court is wrong, how does that impact the sanctions?
Ultimately, the defendant was found in contempt and ultimately disclosed what he had been ordered to disclose. But he received no due process from the Court of Appeals, no opportunity practically to vindicate, try to vindicate those rights that he asserted. And that's what's ultimately troubling. Because if he had no obligation to disclose, because he had a constitutional privilege under NAACP, then he had no business being found in contempt. And there was no business imposing a default judgment for that. So you and the Chief are quite right. Our concern is prospective. But we felt that, as difficult as the facts are in this case, that we had an obligation on behalf of these diverse interests to express a prospective concern. Thank you very much.
Wouldn't the precedent be here that you don't have to plead specific words that are defamatory in order to get discovery if we didn't address that?
Your Honor, I don't think the Court has any choice. The statute, 80203, is really quite clear. And that was raised in the motion to dismiss. But when that motion got decided on July 8th, long after the constitutional rights had been forfeited, that issue was not addressed by the trial court.
Addressed by the parties?
It was raised in the defendant's motion to dismiss specifically. I happened to look at that this morning, so I think I can say that with some confidence.
Chief, if I may, Justice Bradley. You argue that the sanction cannot be sustained if the trial court was wrong. Does your argument then necessarily imply that there has to be an exhaustion of the appellate issue before the sanction can be sustained?
I think that we would all be served by a clear statement from this Court that that's the preferable practice. I don't think this Court needs to mandate, assuming it has the authority absent legislation, I don't think this Court has to mandate that an interlocutory appeal must be granted. But I think this Court can make it very, very clear, as the Delaware Supreme Court did just this month in Cahill, that it is the far, far better practice when constitutional rights are at least facially asserted.
I think that you have to argue more than it's the better practice. I think that you have to argue that it is mandated. Otherwise, your primary argument is that the sanction cannot be sustained. And so it leaves us with an untenable situation. I'm a trial court judge. I have a ruling, and I make a ruling, and the person who will be found in contempt says, you know, something disrespectful with regard to I'm not going to follow it, or doesn't say something just disrespectful and just doesn't follow it. Comes back, and I say, okay, I really mean it, and they say, you know, forget it, Judge, I'm not going to follow it, and I say, now I really, really, really mean it. And you say, okay, but I know you want me to do it now, and I know you want me to do it, you know, by Friday at 5, but let's wait 2 years until it gets through the appellate process. That seems to me what you're really arguing.
No, Your Honor, because the appellate process can move quite quickly. But what happened here was the trial court refused to grant a stay. The parties got a Court of Appeals judge on the telephone. I think it's fair to say at that point the Court of Appeals procedural record is a bit cloudy, but the fact remains that The Court of Appeals wouldn't grant the stay either in the person of a single judge, and the case went on its merry way. And whatever the plaintiff might have done or the defendant might have done in this case, I think we can all say, well, you should have done this or you should have done that. But our concern is prospective, and I'm always reluctant to come to this Court and say, you must mandate a procedure. I'm not sure that a case, as opposed to rulemaking or legislation, is a way to mandate what the Court of Appeals must hear on an interlocutory basis. Because maybe there are cases that are so frivolous, patently unworthy, that the Court of Appeals shouldn't hear an interlocutory. But this case did not get the appellate attention it warranted, given the constitutional issues at stake. They were plain, they were clear, and again, perhaps in the end the defendant would have had to yield, but not on a procedural record like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Ms. McGilvray, representing Julie Lassa.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and members of the Court, for the opportunity to present argument today. My name is Pamela McGilvray. I appear on behalf of Plaintiff Respondent, Senator Julie Lassa. I will address issues related to the Circuit Court proceedings below and to the extensive record that was developed in this case, and then Mr. Skilton will address the constitutional claims that were asserted by the amici and by Mr. Rongstad on appeal. This case is about Senator Lassa's right to pursue legal action against unknown defendants who were responsible for a postcard that was capable of defamatory meaning. As Judge Sumi found, the postcard an ordinary person could reasonably construe the postcard to assert that, as a fact, Senator Lassa was a criminal and that she acted unethically. Judge Sumi also found that plaintiff properly pled the defamatory postcard, not only in the allegations in the complaint itself, but by attaching the postcard as onto the complaint itself so that it was then incorporated into the pleadings. Senator Lassa was never interested in membership lists of the Alliance for a Working Wisconsin, but what she sought was information that would enable her to name the correct defendants to the lawsuit so that she could prove the claim of, or the essential element of actual malice. And Judge Sumi also recognized at the point of deciding the default judgment that Judge Nowakowski's orders, which she found were the law of the case, were not simply that Mr. Rongstad provide the name of the contributors, but that all of his orders up until that date be complied with so that Senator Lassa could get to the information to show, the essential element of actual malice that she would not have been able to have done without Mr. Rongstad disclosing this information because he was the only known source of the information. Here, the question of Senator Lassa's right to the discovery information was well tested below. This matter appeared before the Circuit Court on 6 different motion hearings and before the Court of Appeals twice. Mr. Rongstad was not denied any opportunity to challenge the court's orders.
Ms. McGilvray, excuse me. Mm-hmm. There are obviously important First Amendment concerns that are implicated by this case. What's wrong with following a procedure similar to that followed in Delaware with dealing with, perhaps in an expedited fashion, the motion to dismiss, leaving open the question of malice as a means of protecting the First Amendment rights while also protecting your client?
The motion to dismiss was filed by Mr. Rongstad after the discovery orders were issued by Judge Nowakowski. In fact, but the first appearance before Judge Nowakowski on January 29th, Mr. Rongstad suggested that he intended to file a motion to dismiss. And at that motion hearing, Judge Nowakowski found, well, there's nothing before me now. That is speculative, but I'm invite you to file your motion to dismiss, and then it could be that a stay of discovery would be warranted. That filing was never made, so it was never before Judge Nowakowski. In any event, the Cahill Court, the Delaware Court, found that the motion to dismiss, or that a summary judgment should be held before deciding these associational rights. But the process that happened in Delaware was very similar to the process that was before Judge Sumi on the motion to dismiss, in that while Delaware required notice pleadings, Judge Sumi found that we had pled with the particularity that's required and that we had demonstrated through the postcard that it was defamatory on its face, so that we had met, or so that Senator Lassa had met all of the of the elements of defamation that were within her control. So that when Judge Sumi found in favor of Senator Lassa and denied the motion to dismiss, that was in effect the same test that was put forth in the Delaware court.
But if I understand the argument of both of your opposing counsel, the concern was the order, and at what point should it have been done? Should this be disposed of first, as opposed to down the road, so that everyone's rights are protected, both your clients as well as the First Amendment rights of their client?
Well, I think that the First Amendment rights are very important, and maybe it would be in a different matter that there should be an immediate interlocutory review of that question. The record in this case shows that there was no prima facie case made to begin with, so that the associational rights of Mr. Rongstad were never triggered. Judge Nowakowski found on February 3rd that there was no presentation of evidence to meet Buckley's factual showing of past or present harm or threats of harm, so that the associational rights of the membership organization were never triggered. Therefore, there would be nothing to go up on appeal on this matter.
The affidavit wasn't sufficient, just saying they're afraid of reprisals.
That's what Judge Nowakowski found in the R.N. Senator Lassa's position, that on the follow-up hearing on the motion for reconsideration, Mr. Rongstad presented a conclusory affidavit that stated his members had fear of reprisals. Basically, the legal conclusion that one would have to meet based on the evidence, but there was no evidence presented to test. Judge Nowakowski on the first hearing held it over to the next day, in part so that he could review the extensive constitutional law that was cited by Mr. Rongstad, and that included Buckley versus Vallejo and NAACP versus Alabama, McIntyre, etc., but also so that he could make Mr. Rongstad could make himself available to give testimony, to provide the evidence that would meet the prima facie showing. Mr. Rongstad never provided testimony to the circuit court, and in fact, the only bit of evidence is that two-page affidavit that Judge Nowakowski found insufficient to meet the prima facie showing that a constitutional right was triggered.
Could I ask you a question about the mailing? This is a two-page mailing, two-sided mailing. This is in your beautifully reproduced in your brief. Is there anything defamatory on the cover page?
Justice Prosser, as Judge Sumi found, the postcard implies that, as a fact, Senator Lassa was engaged in extortion and...
Now, that's not my question. Is there anything defamatory on this page right here?
Your Honor, I think what Senator Lassa's position is that the postcard has to be taken as a whole, and that's why it was attached to the pleadings. What Judge Sumi found and what Senator Lassa's position is on this, that Mr. Rongstad attempted to parse the postcard into oblivion so that it would have no meaning. So if you look at it and say, quote, when Chuck said jump, well, that on its own doesn't have defamatory meaning. But when you look at the postcard as a whole with Senator Quala's booking information superimposed on it and the connections that are clearly made between Senator Lassa and that criminal conduct, that that is what was capable of defamatory meaning. And it may have another meaning, too, but the test at the motion to dismiss stage is whether it was capable of defamatory meaning.
What I'm trying to get at is the requirement in the statute for particularity. Would you say that the requirement in the statute for particularity had been met if, let's say, a two-page just text was alleged to contain defamatory comment? If attached to a complaint, the entire two pages of text, is that enough particularity?
Well, in this case, Justice Prosser, in addition to attaching the mailer to the complaint, there was also the reproduction of certain portions of the postcard in the allegations themselves, and with the allegations that that it was accusing or stating that Senator Lassa acted criminally and unethically. So that in addition to the attachment, the pleadings show that what the statements, the defamatory statements were. And as Judge Zumi found, the statutory requirements were correctly met.
Where does it say that she acted criminally or unethically?
On the postcard? But what it is showing is a booking statement, so that she acted as a felon, as Senator Quala is shown to have done in this case. And I guess at that point it was allegedly criminal behavior. But the behavior, the underlying meaning that we were, that Senator Lassa was putting forward, was that the tie to the criminal conduct and asserted as a fact.
Now, 802.036, that's what we're talking about?
Correct.
There's an action for libel or slander, and that's what this is, right? The particular words complained of shall be set forth in the complaint. So if the complaint sets it forth or incorporates it by reference by attaching it, these are the words you're relying on, right?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that is. Those were the words that we were relying on by incorporating it as an attachment. And again, that's what Judge Zumi found as well.
Okay. So we have the particular words. They're not other words.
All the words that we allege were defamatory are contained in that postcard.
Okay. Then the statute goes on to say, but their publication and their application to the plaintiff may be stated generally. So you don't have to do that with particularity, right?
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Did you comply with that latter part, but their publication and their application to the plaintiff may be stated generally?
Yes, that was pled in the complaint that that this would harm her reputation in her community and among her constituents.
So then the issue really may be that it wasn't well enough pleaded. That's one issue. And the other is it may have been pleaded great, but that this isn't defamatory. That's a substantive issue.
Whether it is, meets the actual malice test is a question that was not yet before.
No, but before you get to malice, you got to get to that these words are defamatory. That is, that they subject the party to whatever the language is, ridicule, harm of reputation, et cetera.
That's correct. What at this stage, at the stage that we got to at the motion to dismiss, that the words were capable of defamatory meaning. In addition to the other process that Mr. Roxner was given the opportunity to do but did not take advantage of, that providing testimony to the circuit court on to meet the prima facie showing and filing a motion to dismiss early on with a request for stay. He also did not take advantage of appellate opportunities that were available to him. While he did seek a stay pending appeal of the February 4th discovery order, he never followed through on that with his petition or with his briefing on the petition and the Court of Appeals deemed that abandoned a month later. So he was given the opportunity but did not follow through. What? Similarly, he did not file for permission to appeal the written contempt order that was issued on April 2nd. He only sought appeal of the oral orders that were not entered judgments, and they were dismissed.
But the Court of Appeals said it was going to ignore it, oral versus written. It was just going to make a decision. Let me just ask you, how much was he, what was the penalty per day?
The penalty per day was not assessed immediately after the contempt hearing. Mr. Rongstad had the opportunity to not have any forfeiture at all if he made himself available for deposition within 2 days. But then the fact that he didn't, it began to accrue at $1,000 per day, which he, of course, was the person in control of stopping.
But that seems a little stiff, though, doesn't it? $1,000 a day. Most of us don't make $1,000 a day.
I think,
unfortunately.
I would agree with that. Your Honor, I think if you look back through the transcript and you see the dilatory conduct of Mr. Rongstad and the egregiousness of his behavior, that as early as February 6th, Judge Nowakowski was saying that seldom has he seen such an abuse, and he saw that nothing else would move this matter ahead, so that not only was it a matter between the parties of Senator Lassa not being able to get the information that she sought, but also the court's time and resources were being wasted, so that penalty he felt Judge Nowakowski ordered it to, from Senator Lassa's position, it was necessary. And in fact, in the end, it was not sufficient to have him comply with the court's orders, as Judge Sumi found that he was not in compliance after April 4th.
Here's something that just bothers me about the whole case, to put it in perspective. You've got a mailing, which, as Mr. Williamson can say, because it's not his people that did it or against his people, he says, well, it's not the best kind of thing. It may not be what you want in politics, but you got this mailing, and it is distressing, whether it's First Amendment or protection or not. Not nice, right? I wouldn't want a mailing to go out on me that has a picture of me jumping, and it says I jump whenever Attorney Williamson or Attorney Crooks or Attorney Skilton or Attorney Garvey say something. I picked them and not you because I know them over the years. And they know me, you know, so we don't know each other. But so I'm picking people that over the years I've had association with across the bench or across the table. That wouldn't be very nice, right? Especially for a judge, but anybody to be in somebody else's pocket jumping. Right? That's the one part of the picture. Second part of the picture is you got a suit for defamation. And that has a chilling effect. Anyone who sued, when that summons is served, let me tell you, you're chilled. And when you have to go to a lawyer and get counsel and have to pay it, you're even more chilled. Right? And you're not only personally chilled because of the personal effect it has on your time and effort. This is the defendant. But everybody else who is thinking of getting into the political arena and taking part in the political discussion, which can be hard, and the First Amendment says it can be hard and harsh and unfair. You stand for election, that's part of the problem, or challenge, or opportunity. So how do you balance, on the one hand, the protection of an individual's reputation? I mean, even a political figure, one assumes, has an interest in reputation, against free speech and the political process and not chilling it. Both sides here have rights and both sides have responsibilities.
How do we balance that?
Well, Your Honor, certainly Senator Lassa understands that politics can be nasty, and she was prepared for the rough and tumble. But what was at issue here was assertions of illegal and unethical conduct. But I think that the standards are already set forth under federal law, under New York Times versus Sullivan, which reaches that balance by requiring the showing of actual malice for a public figure, and also under Buckley versus Vallejo's balancing test to make sure that the interests are balanced out. So I don't know that any new test would be necessary to meet to find the line between those two competing interests.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Skilton.
May it please the court. John Skilton. And I would like to address some of the issues the court has been concerned about with my remarks. With respect to the balancing issue, it is an issue that both constitutionally has been addressed in the Buckley-McIntyre set of cases. And as to that issue, I believe you're going to find on the February 4th transcript from Judge Nowakowski a correct review of what the Constitution, really a remarkably sophisticated reading of those two cases. In 18 hours, I think it probably would have taken me 6 weeks, but it's good and it's right. And it tells the court, the trial court, how you address the question of whether or not compelled disclosure should be ordered. And disclosure of contributors with the loss of anonymity. He handled that correctly. He handled it pursuant to law. He found that the showing was not sufficient to support a prima facie case of the assertion of the constitutional right of non-disclosure, and he ordered disclosure. He followed the law. It was the correct constitutional analysis. Now, the court has raised the issue of balancing, and I'm very proud to say that I'm actually the one who found that Delaware case with all the hotshot young lawyers around, and it was because it was in the American Lawyer. And it's a very interesting case, and it really spills into everything that the court is dealing with, because as the Delaware court found in that case, it was the first case, Supreme Court case, a state Supreme Court case, to address the question of public figure in the context of the issue of defamation and how you hit the balance. And I think what's most important about that case for this court in this case is that it announced a new rule, a rule that it created almost out of whole cloth. It's brand new, and it's prospective by definition. And the balance it struck, it's an interesting constitutional balance, I think, for anyone who's interested in the Constitution, because it ignores the Buckley-Vallejo balancing and said that the only balancing that we need to do in the context of a slander and libel case is the question of whether the plaintiff can meet a summary judgment attack prima facie. And it eliminates actual malice because it says, after all, in order to determine that and make a showing on it, you have to have discovery. Now, that's not in the context of election, interestingly. It was the blogging situation that everybody's faced with. It was, however, an elected official, and it's clearly relevant. But the point of the discussion of the case is to say that that's a new rule, and what Mr. Williamson, my dear friend, comes in and says to the court is that I want you now to declare that's the only way to go here. And by the way, it would be nice to apply it to this case, but it doesn't work in this case. Wisconsin's rules of civil procedure and appellate procedure are not broken. They do not need to be fixed. The issue that's raised on this appeal is essentially an attempt to rewrite history. And that the history that I'm talking about is the procedural history in front of Judge Nowakowski in the order of the motions that were brought. And Mr. Williamson suggests it was in the wrong order. But you know, a court can't move without a motion. And the motion that really is being suggested to this court that should have been brought and wasn't is a motion for a protective order that the court not permit any discovery unless and until it passes on the sufficiency of the libel count. And that should have been in the court proper at the right time, at the right place. You know, the issue, as I understand it, and I must say my understanding of the record is not nearly as good as Mr. Crook's, and so the court's going to have to go back and find it. But the limited point, basically, is that is not – Judge Nowakowski was aware that motion was not in front of him. What he did instead was to follow what he understood to be the law of the United States from the United States Supreme Court and read carefully the Buckley case and the McIntyre case.
But sometime during this proceeding on the discovery, a motion to dismiss was made, right?
It was made. I'm not sure of the dates, but I believe it may have been made sometime around March. Maybe earlier. I don't want to misrepresent the record, but it was made after certainly the initial constitutional ruling ordering discovery.
There was still time for the judge to change his mind, for the circuit court to change his mind.
Yes, if in fact that was a requirement, which goes to the question that I'm raising here. The procedure was adequate to have brought it in front of him. The question was that a legal requirement that Judge Nowakowski had to follow in any event, or is it a prospective rule that has been brought into the dialogue as a result of the Delaware situation? And I believe Judge Nowakowski commented on the record that I'm not aware of any rule that requires me to make this determination in this order. This is relevant discovery in a libel case.
It would be good, though, to decide whether there's a valid claim before you go through discovery. Now, I know that in many cases you do the discovery because it assists you in refining what your claim really is and what kind of evidence you can bring forth.
I don't argue the notion that it's good to have a valid claim, a bona fide, good faith, Rule 11 sustaining E14025 type claim. That's a good idea.
Right.
But I'm asking the court to say to itself, is that a requirement to permit any discovery, and should a court be required to follow that under the rules as they now exist?
Aren't you really saying that in this case it didn't have to be, and ultimately it was found that the motion to dismiss was not valid, and therefore what you have is an order for discovery that wasn't obeyed?
Yeah, maybe, but I guess I'd say that the fact of the matter is that reading Judge Nowakowski, you know, there's an anger that is commented on the briefs of Judge Nowakowski. If we're speculating on what he would have done, my guess would be, had Mr. Crooks decided to get that motion to him post-haste, he would probably have found that it was liable. But he didn't. It was later found liable by Judge Sumi that it was liable and that it withstood attack. But that was not directly addressed, in fact, by Judge Nowakowski in issuing his orders. You know, in prior life, I actually represented the media. Sorry, Brady. But the fact is that the rules permit immediate attack of trial court orders, and our rules do as well. And it's in the form of a request for a stay followed by a request for emergency appeals and the like. So the issues here sort out at various levels of concern. But what I think is really trying to be force-fed on, shoehorned to the court, is an issue of law not declared in Wisconsin as of the time of these proceedings, that you cannot, in the context of a libel case, permit any discovery, even on relevant information such as malice and actual intent, until you pass on the bona fides or sufficiency of the libel case. That's new law in this state, no matter what. Whether the right procedures were available or not, that's the rule of Delaware, and that is new law. And we have to deal with what the trial court does in the context of the law then declared. That's the only thing that's fair to the trial judge, in my mind. And he did it. How else does he enforce his orders, by the way? And these were four separate hearings. It's not as if Judge Nowakowski lost sleep at night and ordered the contempt proceeding. There were four different separate hearings on the issue of compliance. And ultimately, there was none. So the consequence of the court being too cavalier here is the trial judge is being said you can't ever enforce your order until 2 years later.
What about the constitutional issue?
The constitutional issues are very interesting here. I think we all start with a premise of favoring the First Amendment and robust speech. I don't think there's any doubt in my mind. And obviously, the closer the case is, the more like speech it is, and so on and so forth. And that's founded really in Justice Stevenson's remarks, I believe, in the McIntyre case. I'll read them, but basically his position is, in general, our society accords greater weight to the value of free speech than to the dangers of misuse. And that's a good way to start any analysis, and I agree with that. But there is an issue here that is sleeping in McIntyre and all the analyses here, and that is libel is not protected speech. And one of the things you see, and particularly you see it in Justice Scalia's dissent, is that McIntyre reaches political speech, no doubt about it, and is concerned about the $100, or whatever it is, the pamphlet, and the $100 fine, and the lady that died before it went up, and all of that. Those are all very important issues in McIntyre. But the issue of libel is not directly addressed in McIntyre. It's carved out, and it's important to carve it out when you're talking about the constitutional analysis, because it gets into the weighing and the balancing and how you deal with it. There is no doubt in any reading of the United States Supreme Court cases, I don't care what the decision is, that libel and slander are still available common law remedies to an injured person. And the constitutional issue rides outside of that.
Counsel.
Now, it's not to say that it's implicated by it, because there are associational issues that are involved, and I would readily acknowledge that you have to get into a constitutional analysis here. No doubt on that, and I'm not fighting that point. But I do think it really does get to some of the important issues that go both ways. But one of the justices, I don't remember who, asked whether there was a compelling interest of the state. Yes, there is. It's founded in U versus San Francisco, quoted by Justice Scalia, and it says the state has a compelling interest, constitutional language, in preserving the integrity of its election process. The electorate has a right not to be defrauded. I don't think there's any doubt about that, and that has to be as high a level, really, in terms of this court's consideration as the First Amendment. So we're really right in the middle of some very important issues here as we deal with it.
We sure are. And I want to get back to the balancing test of some of these important issues. My concern is that the abuse that can come from, if this court follows your recommendation on the law. Now, we're dealing here with parties, and let's say they're all, you know, honorable and respectable people. Let's start with that. But what about the person who comes, who is using this as nothing more than a harassment tool? But it can still argue, as does Senator Lassa, that I need this information in order to go forward with my case, number one, and I need this information to clear my name. Those are my interests. I can hear a myriad of plaintiffs saying those are the interests. And so how
do we deal with it?
Okay.
Well, that's exactly the question the Delaware court dealt with. And recognize, Justice Bradley, in the very terms you're speaking, it's paraphrasing the competing interest here. And basically, they balance it by saying, we are going to create a rule of law that requires someone to withstand summary judgment on four of the five elements of the libel count in order to proceed. That's about as simple as that. But that is not the law of Wisconsin as it now exists. And it is a balancing test. Interestingly, one that doesn't, it forswears constitutional analysis. It says it's already, we've done enough balancing, they said. We don't have to look at the Buckley-Vallejo-type balancing. This satisfies the issue. I want to raise a counter-issue, though, because I believe this case is very important to this state and to its citizens. And that is the danger of a slime ad put in the heat of an election with no time to respond, taking a candidate and basically labeling that candidate a crook. And the question is, what is the remedy there for the person who has been so injured, and how? You see, it's no remedy at all in some situations to say you can sue later in libel, take 2 years to litigate it, and get an apology at the end of the road if you've lost the election. The happy fact is Senator Lassa did not lose this election, but it is the issue of how fast this thing goes if the court is going to start setting new rules is material to the question of how the defamed person can have her remedy satisfied in a context where it is being used for political purposes, to wit, to win an election. Path of least resistance, get rid of your opposition. Doesn't matter what it is, because the best you can, most you're going to have to do is apologize at the end of the day. So if this court's going to start putting requirements on its trial judges concerning prima facie showings of libel, it ought to have some controls going the other way. In a situation of emergency where there is real libel, we want this heard immediately, because otherwise the damage is done and there is no remedy and the election is over. So if we start going down the direction of advisory opinion that Mr. Williamson and his candidates are suggesting we do, then I think this court better consider fully that there are two interests to be balanced here. There are the persons who are chilled from doing it, and there are the candidates who are chilled from ever trying it.
Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Before you proceed with rebuttal, Mr. Crooks, we have to change our recording disc, so it'll just take a few moments. Mr. Crooks.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. Let me start out by saying I do understand that Mr. Skilton was not involved all the way along, so he probably doesn't know the procedural history as well as I do, because the first thing I did in this case was file a motion for a protective order, just like he says I should do. And what I asked the court to do was give me some time, given the fact that this complaint was filed on January 16th of 03, served on January 22nd of 03. On January 29th of 03, I was in there saying, I need a protective order so that I can file my motion to dismiss. When that was denied, we were ordered to appear for deposition, which had been noticed to start on January 30 of 03, the next day. I happened to have a trial in another matter, so the judge gave me some reprieve to February 3rd of 03, 3 days. On February 4th of 03, when the second day of the deposition was going forward and we raised these constitutional objections, we filed a motion for leave to appeal. We were on the telephone with Judge Lunston asking him to grant a stay so that those issues could be entertained. We asked for a supervisory writ, which he said, we can't do, we don't have enough of a record here yet, and he denied the request for a stay. February 6th of 03, we file our motion to reconsider Judge Nowakowski's order. February 11th of 03, we filed the motion to dismiss. 3 weeks after the complaint was filed in this case, 2 weeks after it was served, and after a myriad of other activities had taken place. I may have misheard when Ms. McKilvery was arguing,
But I thought in response to one of Justice Bradley's questions, she conceded that what should have happened here was an interlocutory appeal so that the First Amendment issues could be addressed. With respect to Justice Prosser's questions concerning the specificity needed with respect to this, I think the Court needs to look no further than 80203 sub 6 and its own precedent in Tater v. Solsrud, 174 with second 735, which says, a defamation plaintiff must allege the particular words complained of in his complaint. Merely attaching to the complaint letters alleged to contain defamatory statements does not satisfy the requirement. With respect to Justice Butler's question, I believe it may have been Justice Prosser, but one of you asked, don't we have to follow the trial court? Well, this court also has the trial court's discovery orders. We can't ignore those. This court also has a precedent, the Burnett versus Alt case, which says if there is a substantiated privilege that a litigant can ignore the discovery orders that come down from a trial court. That's exactly what happened in here. While the privilege in Burnett versus Alt may not have been recognized by all the justices on this court as a legitimate privilege, I don't think anyone can argue with the concept that the First Amendment is a legitimate privilege. So we're going through this during rapid fire. Things are coming at us left and right, and we're aware of the Burnett versus Alt case, which gives us the right to ignore the discovery orders if we think we've got a substantiated right. And if the First Amendment isn't a substantiated right, then there are no substantiated rights.
Does one make any request a substantiated right?
Excuse me, Justice?
Doesn't that make any apparent claim of privilege a substantiated right? I mean, that was a one sentence in Alt.
Well,
undefined.
I agree with you. It is undefined.
Evidentiary privilege.
It is undefined. The substantiated right is undefined. But I think everyone on this court and probably everyone in the courtroom can agree that the First Amendment claim of privilege is a substantiated right. And if it is an existing precedent of the court, which has not been overruled, and which litigants in the situation that we found ourselves are entitled to follow. And that's exactly what we did here.
Mr. Crooks, I have two questions. One is about the substantiated right. Don't you have to have a prima facie case, and didn't Judge Nowakowski rule against you on that in order to assert the privilege?
Judge Nowakowski, well, if we allow, Justice Butler, if we allow Judge Nowakowski's ruling to stand in that regard, then we are allowing Judge Nowakowski to be judge, jury, and appellate court in this particular situation. Yes, he ruled against us. He ruled against us after he pointed out in a non-evidentiary hearing that we hadn't presented any evidence to show that we could suffer irreparable harm. He then allowed us to submit the affidavit in conjunction with a motion for reconsideration, and he said, it's plain on it's nothing but conclusory.
And Chief, if I could, one last question.
Justice Butler?
A lot of what I hear, the frustration coming from you, has to deal with the speed at which this proceeded, not giving you time to prepare, not giving you an opportunity to get a proper motion to dismiss file and to get time to do it correctly. I'm looking at McIntyre case, where the court stated that the state interest in preventing fraud and libel stands on a different footing. We agree with Ohio's submission that this interest carries special weight during election campaigns when false statements, if credited, may have serious adverse consequences for the public at large. Where the court concluded is that you can't, however, punish fraud indirectly by indiscriminately outlawing a category of speech based on content with no necessary relationship to the danger sought to be prevented. Isn't it, given that language and the consequences for the public at large, doesn't the court have an obligation to try to get this decided and decided quickly so as to protect the public's interests?
Absolutely. And if you look at the transcript with respect to the first hearing in front of Judge Nowakowski, I think I said words to the effect, Judge, I'm not asking for a month. I'm not asking for weeks. Just give us a few days so I can file our motion to dismiss. So I don't quarrel with you at all, especially during an election cycle. Speed is of the essence. But to ignore constitutional rights for the purpose of protecting a public official who isn't entitled to extra protection that other members of society are entitled to, I think was wrong. I think it was an incorrect process, and I think that's primarily why we're here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crooks. I want to thank all the counsel who have presented argument and have filed excellent briefs. Mr. Crooks, Mr. Williamson, Ms. McGilvray, Mr. Skelton, and those who filed amicus briefs who did not appear in this very interesting and important constitutional issue case. That closes the hearing on 2004 AP 377, Lassa v. Rongstead. The court is in recess until 1:30.